and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 11th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto. From the front page of today's Gazette, under the heading Iowa Ideas 2022, Energy Pushback, Politics Increasingly Play a Role in Solar and Wind, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Quietly powering a building, or a farm, or a house, early solar projects in Iowa sparked initial curiosity before becoming part of the Iowa landscape. But as Iowa utility companies seek to make solar power a bigger part of the energy mix, spurred by the need to limit greenhouse gases to reduce the impacts of climate change, proposed solar installations have grown in size and number, causing more pushback from neighbors. Some of the concerns are based on misinformation. Solar panels don't increase flood risk or cause dangerous glare, but some opponents have legitimate questions about how utility-scale solar projects will affect their pockets of rural Iowa. The advocates will say the land is a drop in the bucket in the state, said Sarah Alden, a CenterPoint woman who started the website Iowa for Responsible Solar. A proposed 200-megawatt solar installation by Palo is near Alden's home in western Linn County. The next extra energy project is slated to use about 1,200 acres of land. Not much when you consider Linn County is 460,000 acres, but as more neighbors sell their land to Next Era, Alden worries about the impact. Rolling hills, lots of trees. The road is called Green Grove for a reason, Alden said. My husband and I have a dream to live in the country. We sacrificed a lot to save money to buy a little land and build a house, and now we are being industrialized. There also is new politicization of wind and solar energy. While most Americans continue to support expanding solar, 84%, and wind farms, 77%, Republicans and Democrats have become more divided, the Pew Research Center reported in June 2021. More than 90% of Democrats and left-leaning independents support solar and wind, Pew reported. But among Republicans and Republican-leaning survey respondents, support for solar power went from 84% in 2020 to 73% in 2021, Pew reported. Support for wind drops from 75% in 2020 to 62% a year later. MidAmerican Energy has a goal of providing 100% renewable energy to its customers by 2025. Alliant Energy wants to have net zero carbon emissions from the electricity the company generates by 2050. Electricity generation in the United States in 2020 resulted in 1.55 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide, which equaled about 0.85 pounds of CO2 emissions per kilowatt hour of energy produced, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. U.S. power plants that burned coal, natural gas, and petroleum were the source of about 62% of U.S. electricity generation in 2020, but accounted for 99% of power-related carbon dioxide emissions. The agency considers electricity from renewable sources, including wind, solar, hydro, and biomass, to be carbon neutral. Saving the planet isn't the only motivation for utilities. Many of their industrial customers are insisting on cleaner power. Wind power came to Iowa well before solar, with a 1983 bill requiring investor-owned utilities in Iowa to purchase wind power. Then-Governor Terry Branstad, a Republican, advocated for wind power in the 1980s and through 2016, when he recognized it in his Condition of the State address as a way for farmers to make money from turbine lease payments. Nearly 60% of Iowa's electricity comes from wind, the largest share in the nation. MidAmerican has more than 3,400 wind turbines across the state, with most concentrated in western and central Iowa. These wind farms generate enough electricity to power 2.3 million households a year, the company reported. A night drive along Interstate 80 from Iowa City to Des Moines shows a horizon blinking with red lights marking the tops of wind turbine towers. Alliant owns and operates 1,299 megawatts of wind generation in Iowa, which is enough to power more than 500,000 homes, the company reported. But unlike wind farms developed in the 1990s and 2010s, newer installations have drawn more criticism in Iowa. News headlines shed light on Iowans' concerns with wind. Wind turbines haven't been universally welcomed by everyone in Iowa, the Gazette, February 23, 2019. Report: sound from wind turbines does not harm human health. The Gazette, January 31, 2019. Flickers and stray voltage, why these Iowans really hate wind power. Des Moines Register, April 21, 2017. With half of Iowa's 99 counties having utility-scale wind farms in operation or development by 2017, the Iowa Environmental Council reported, more than half of Iowa's counties now have rules for siting, safety, infrastructure needs, and decommissioning turbines. The council recommends minimum setbacks from residential properties of 1,000 to 1,250 feet and limits on turbine sounds of no lower than 50 dBA, decibels weighted for the human ear. For counties interested in attracting all of the local benefits that come with wind generation, a well-drafted and balanced wind siting ordinance is an important initial step, the environmental group wrote. Solar is heating up in Iowa. MidAmerican just started developing solar last year, said Adam Jablonski, the company's vice president of resource development. MidAmerican has only 5 solar projects, including a 3-megawatt facility open in Hills earlier this year. The Hills site was on land MidAmerican already owned. The company did an environmental study and then went through the design and permitting process. The utility started construction in spring 2021 and opened in early 2022. That one was pretty good, smooth sailing, Jablonski said. We got good support from the county. We talked with the adjacent landowner to make sure he was aware of it. He had no concerns. Even with a larger project, the 117-megawatt Holiday Creek Solar Project in Webster County, slated to be fully operational in 2022, MidAmerican has not encountered significant resistance, officials said. But 2 large-scale solar developments in Linn County have faced open opposition from some neighbors. Clenera and SIPCO announced in April 2021 their plan to open a 100-megawatt solar project near Coggin. Linn County Planning and Zoning in November voted 6-1 against rezoning agricultural land to allow for the solar farm. This was after some neighbors expressed concern about taking farmland out of production, the looks of solar farms, reduced property values, and the county's ability to enforce ordinances. Cornfields are just as important to me as oceanfront property, Greg Bickle, owner of Bickle Koi Farm, said at a public meeting last year. This is my retirement property, and I've dreamed of this, and now I'm going to be surrounded by solar panels on 3 sides. The Linn County Board of Supervisors voted 2-1 in January to allow Coggin Solar to proceed. The site is expected to be operational by 2023. Iowa for Responsible Solar's Alden opposed Coggin Solar, and she's against the NextEra project near Palo, but she's made clear she's not against solar in all situations. We have tons of concrete parking garages, rooftops. Why are we not utilizing that space, she said. To turn productive prime farm ground into a part-time electric generation facility is just not responsible. MidAmerican's Jablonski said rooftop solar projects usually are smaller scale and panels usually don't move to track the sun, which lowers productivity. Republicans are more than twice as likely as Democrats, 65% to 30%, to say wind and solar are unreliable, the Pew Research Center study found. Republicans also are more likely to say wind and solar cost more than other energy sources. More than 80% of Democrats say producing power from wind is better for the environment, according to 45% of Republicans, Pew found. And where Branstad touted Iowa's leadership in wind, his successor, Governor Kim Reynolds, also a Republican, has not mentioned the state's wind ranking in recent condition of the state addresses. Instead, she promotes corn-based ethanol and biodiesel. More than 2,800 people have signed an online petition on the Iowa for Responsible Solar website. Belinda Scott of Cedar Rapids wrote on the site that she wants NextEra to find another spot for the solar farm, proposed land near the Duane Arnold Energy Center, a nuclear factory that started its decommissioning process in 2020. There is plenty of land around to use without tearing up a neighborhood and uprooting families, Scott wrote. Families have already been torn by the closing of this plant. There are more important things than money. Find another place. Also, from the front page of today's Gazette, under the heading Marking 9/11, Younger CR Vets on Mission to Change Old Man's Club. Organizations shrink as young vets hesitant to join, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. In Cedar Rapids, Derek Clay hunches down next to Navy veteran Bill Dittmar of Cedar Rapids for a quick chat before lunch is served at the Freedom Foundation in Northeast Cedar Rapids. Behind them, a pair of Vietnam War vets shoot pool and playfully rib one another as volunteers begin serving plates of pasta, breadsticks, and salad. The room is filled with more than 70 veterans. Save for Clay and a few others, nearly all are well over the age of 65, with Korean and Vietnam veterans making up the bulk of those gathered. Clay, a 34-year-old staff sergeant in the Iowa National Guard, who deployed to Afghanistan in 2010, is the newest and youngest board member of the Veterans Organization. The nonprofit provides programming and services for veterans, including a food pantry, employment placement program, a temporary housing and shelter program for homeless and displaced veterans, a Veterans Emergency Financial Assistance Fund, and free weekly meal. A lot of the veterans around here will say, "Hey, it's great to see an actual young face in here," Clay said, so it's not a secret or anything that veteran service organizations are struggling to see the younger people. More than two decades after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, the nation's oldest and largest veteran service organizations are seeing their ranks diminish with the deaths of World War II, Korean, and Vietnam veterans, and the hesitancy of younger veterans to fill the void and join legacy groups such as the Veterans of Foreign Wars, or VFW, and the American Legion. It comes at a time when veteran advocates say programs and services for 9/11 vets are needed just as much now as they were generations ago. Some posts across the country have shut their doors or restructured because of low membership, a shrinking veteran population, and being unable to bounce back from the COVID-19 pandemic, which strained finances, participation, and outreach. Both the VFW and American Legion say Vietnam-era veterans make up the largest portion of their membership. Only about 15% of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who are eligible to join the VFW have done so. Membership in the VFW peaked at 2.1 million in the early 1990s. It is down to about 1.5 million today. The American Legion claims nearly 2 million members, down from 3.1 million three decades ago. Veterans of the War on Terrorism, interviewed by the Gazette, say they see the veterans groups as fraternities of older men from previous wars who primarily hang out in dimly lit beer halls playing pool, darts, or cards. They say the traditional organizations differ in many ways from groups that appeal to them, including their ways of communicating. "The Iraq and Afghanistan vets are like the digital age, you know," said Jason Everett, an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran who serves in the Iowa National Guard and works for Willis Dady Homeless Services. The nonprofit provides shelter, case management, homeless prevention, and veteran support in Cedar Rapids and the surrounding area. "I came back from a deployment and played Call of Duty for a year and a half or 2 years and went to college and didn't connect with anybody," said Everett, who deployed with Clay and joined him Thursday at the Freedom Foundation luncheon. "I think we haven't figured out how to reach out and get these Iraq and Afghanistan vets who are in their basements and are not civically connected and get them out and be connected. And we haven't found new, innovative ways to speak their language and connect them in a way that's best for them." Iraq and Afghanistan veterans say they are looking for groups that allow them to stay active, continue to serve their country, and interact with civilians to help reintegrate into society after serving overseas. They say it's important for younger veterans who have been part of an all-volunteer force to be able to continue to serve their community and country. Ken Holvenstadt is a 37-year-old Iraq veteran and a member of VFW Post 788 in Cedar Rapids. "I wasn't done serving," Holvenstadt said of joining the VFW, American Legion, and Marine Corps League. "And as a younger veteran, that was something that was special to me than going and having a pint every once in a while at the pub and sharing stories. You know, I really wanted to have that bond and have that mission, because when you're in the military, you have a mission. And when you get out of the military, your mission is different. And if you don't have a mission, then that's when you start to get into drugs or gambling or alcohol or abusive natures." Part of the problem in recruiting younger veterans, Holvenstadt said, is the VFW's difficulty in explaining what services it provides. He said most younger veterans think of the local VFW post as just a bar. Rick Martin says it's a common misperception that the organization is working its damnedest to change. "We're trying to get an image out there other than being just a social, beer-drinking, smoking old fart sea storytelling group," he said. Turning to the Iowa Today and the recap of news across the state in the week in Iowa, under the heading In the News, Palo Solar, the Linn County supervisors last week gave final approval to rezoning land near Palo for a utility-scale solar farm. NextEra plans to have the two Palo projects operating by December 2024. Construction is projected to begin in the first quarter of next year. Alliant Energy is seeking state approval to buy the facility and operate it. NextEra, which has operated in Iowa since 1999 and has 12 wind farms in the state, said it plans to invest $800 million in the project, including $50 million paid to landowners for voluntary easements over the project's 30-year lifespan. The Iowa Utilities Board has approved the projects. Higher education budget request. The Iowa Board of Regents, which governs the state's three public universities, is seeking $34.7 million in additional state appropriations next year, the largest requested increase in decades. The board said the rate of inflation, including employee and labor costs, contributed to the high request. If approved, state funding for the region's schools would increase to $610.5 million next year. New political ads. The pre-election advertising blitz in Iowa picked up steam last week with U.S. Representatives Marionette Miller-Meeks and Ashley Hinson, both Republicans, and Republican Governor Kim Reynolds releasing the first ads of the general election. Hinson's ad features an Iowa veteran thanking Hinson for pushing legislation to expand access to mental health services for rural veterans. Reynolds' ad focuses on her policy record, including eliminating retirement income tax and strengthening protections for law enforcement. Here in Iowa, America still works, the ad says. Miller-Meeks' ad highlights her background as an ophthalmologist, noting a medical residency brought her to the state and tells Iowans she knows your life and fights your fight. It's backed by a $2 million buy and will air until Election Day. Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley also released a digital ad accusing his Democratic opponent Mike Franken of lying to superior officers. In the ad, a short clip, Franken is shown saying he inflated the cost of a military operation in Burundi, fearing the U.S. would become bogged down in the African country. Under the heading Senate Teamwork, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said Senate Republicans need teamwork to flip the chamber to Republican control in 2022, after a public disagreement between Senate Republican leaders prompted questions about the party's chances in the midterms. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell ruffled feathers last month after appearing to doubt candidate quality in some Republican races, causing blowback from Senator Rick Scott, who runs the GOP's Senate campaign arm. Grassley said Wednesday he thinks Republicans have good candidates all over, and he believes the party will take control of the Senate after the November election. Under the heading, they said, "We just want to continue to stay focused on the fact that we're not out of the pandemic, and we could see a surge this fall of Omicron or another subvariant too. And what we've seen with the original vaccine is it's very protective against serious illness, hospitalization, and death." University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics Chief Pharmacy Officer Mike Brownlee on the importance of new COVID-19 boosters. "I urge all eligible but unregistered Iowans to take just 3 minutes this month and register to vote. If you're already registered, make sure the information we have on file is up to date," Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate on registering to vote before the November election. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Governor Debate, Republican incumbent Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she has accepted an invitation to debate her Democratic opponent, Deidre DeGeer, on Iowa PBS. The debate will be broadcast live at 7 p.m. on October 17th. GOP AGs bet big on Byrd. The Republican Attorneys General Association contributed $1 million to Republican Iowa Attorney General candidate Brenna Byrd. Byrd faces incumbent Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat and the longest-serving Attorney General in the United States. Train merger. Quad City area governments are split on a proposed railway merger between Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern that would increase train traffic in the area. The Scott County supervisors last week sent a letter to the Federal Surface Transportation Board in opposition to the merger, joining the city of Comanche in opposing the deal. The supervisors cited higher traffic and noise along the proposed route. The city of LeClaire joined other towns last week in accepting a $750,000 settlement to offset the effects of the merger. And under the heading Water Cooler, Iowans praise Queen. Iowa politicians joined a chorus of global leaders in paying tribute to Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's longest reigning monarch, who died Thursday at the age of 96. Governor Kim Reynolds said the Queen was a remarkable and steadfast woman who fought side by side with the United States through some of the free world's most trying times. "I'll always admire her fortitude, love of freedom, and tenacity that has inspired other women in leadership. As Queen, she was a tremendous source of stability and clearly loved the people she served. She'll forever be a symbol of decency and humanity for the whole world. Queen Elizabeth II leaves a remarkable legacy of duty, honor, and service," Senator Chuck Grassley said. And COVID-19 cases drop. Iowa's new virus cases dropped to 4,176 in the week ending Wednesday, down from 4,908 the previous week. The number of people hospitalized increased a bit, up to 270 from 265 the previous week. Turning to the Insight page and a column from editorial fellow Nicole Shaw, "What are you?" It's the question that's haunted me for much of my life. What are you? It's a question I get all the time, one that makes me feel as if I'm definitely other. It's a question I've been getting since I was little, playing jump rope on the blacktop of my elementary school, the recess supervisor singling me out from the rest of the white kids on the playground. It's hard to know who you are in and of itself without having people asking what you are, as if you aren't even worthy enough to be considered a person, but rather a thing, an unknown other, separate from the familiar. Words are powerful. I think it can be easy to forget that with all the content we consume every day. When the next big scandal or politically incorrect snafu happens on the internet, it's usually forgotten within hours, as the next big thing comes along. But I want to remind everyone that words matter. They have meaning and should be chosen with intent. Carelessness today has the potential to be devastating. As an individual, continuously growing into their identity, I have come to regard myself as a multiracial queer woman. I'm Black and Polish, with a little Native American thrown in for my great-grandfather, although I am unaware what tribe I specifically derive from. I'm gay and I'm a woman. That being said, I consider all those label markers of my identity, ones that coalesce into the person I am, as I cannot be one without the other. They are intertwined in their intersectionality. All of them have shaped the way I act, the way I present myself, the way I view myself, and the way others interact with me as well. The question, "What are you?" has haunted me for much of my life. So I decided to pick it apart and try to understand why that's a question a stranger would feel compelled to ask me, without regard for how the phrasing might come across as dehumanizing and exclusionary. As a queer woman, the question immediately resents any notion of intersectionality, a concept that gives an awareness to the interconnected nature of social categorizations such as race, class, and gender, as they apply to a given individual, according to the Oxford Dictionary. Intersectionality is an important concept to perceive and understand, as no one person is just one thing. People are inherently complex and cannot be regarded as a single label because it takes away from the depth and character that shapes them into the very person they are. Thus, getting asked that question of what you are comes across as labeling an act that discriminately shapes the subject as other, removing them from the self and applying abridged stereotypes to a person. Human beings are inherently complex creatures with unique personalities, and it's part of our nature to want to identify with a group, as we are not solitary creatures in our behavior. However, the way that one identifies with a particular group or social categorization is not, nor is it ever, limited to one single marker. We are not that simplistic, and it's terribly damaging to dumb down a person to one label. With that, I urge people to stop boxing others in, to stop making assumptions based on stereotypes, and instead make an effort to recognize other humans as individuals, ones people can foster resilient connections with as we endure these chaotic, volatile times in our history. The question, "What are you?" is harmful. It's something I have gotten used to, as I'm sure other marginalized individuals have, whether it be because of their race, sexuality, or gender presentation. But it's not something I should be used to getting asked. With this reading, I can only hope those who have asked this question before realize how the subjects of it feel when asked. Some of those in power are quick to brush off the concerns of minorities and label them as snowflakes who cannot take any criticism. However, I urge them to consider a time in which their humanity was ever put into question, to consider if they've ever been regarded as less than a human being, an object of someone's curiosity because they didn't care enough to understand intersectionality. See me for who I am, not what. And turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller of Green Bay, it's a two-panel strip. In the first panel, we see two men across a divided chasm. On the left, the man is yelling, "America is divided because of you." On the right, the man is yelling, "America is divided because of you." The second panel, we see that the chasm is actually in front of a gravestone, and it's a grave dug in the ground with the headstone that says, "Democracy, R.I.P., as the two men still fume at each other. First letter is from John Frazee of Cedar Rapids, Hinson standing up against bad policy. Joe Biden has been pushing for this outrageous plan that transfers student loan debt onto the backs of taxpayers. Those of us who choose not to go to college and work instead, or who already paid off our own student loan debt, now have to pay for the debt of others. How is that right? Few are standing up against this despicable policy, and I'm proud that my Congresswoman, Ashley Hinson, is leading the charge. Being the fighter she is, Ashley is pushing back against Biden's radical policies like this one. She cares about hardworking families and our hard-earned taxpayer dollars. She is strong-witted, intelligent, and a brick wall against the Biden agenda. Ashley has my full support, and I look forward to her serving Iowans for years to come. John Frazee of Cedar Rapids. Next, Leslie Carpenter of Marion writes, Hinson silent about Trump's conduct. Where is Representative Ashley Hinson's outrage now? The Department of Justice continues to provide information about classified government documents stored at Mar-a-Lago, and even former Attorney General William Barr said this week that the government was being jerked around by the former president. Hinson's response to the August 8th Mar-a-Lago search, in which she called for Department of Justice to immediately explain their justification for this unprecedented raid, cast doubt on the Department of Justice. She could have called on Trump to be transparent about why a search warrant was needed to retrieve documents from his home. She could have waited for more information to make an informed comment. Failing that, she could speak up now that there is information suggesting the government has built a solid case. But Hinson is silent. She is unwilling to speak about the true outrage, a former president potentially having engaged in illegal conduct and harm it may have caused. She has treated this as a political game and not the potential national security crisis it is. Hinson does not deserve re-election. I urge you to vote for Liz Mathis. Leslie Carpenter of Marion. Next, Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids writes, President Biden's math equals division. President Biden skipped some elementary math classes. He can't add, subtract, or multiply. All he can do is divide. Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids. Next, Eileen McDermott of Cedar Rapids writes, City needs to address junk properties in CR. Why is Cedar Rapids and Linn County allowing all these junk properties all over town? Some of them look like small junkyards. I believe there's a city ordinance against this, yet when you call and report these properties, nothing gets done. Mailing a citation, which is protocol, does absolutely nothing. Putting them on a list does absolutely nothing. I'd say clean it up or get out, aka eviction. If it's a homeowner situation, shame on you. Every side of town has one of these eyesores in their neighborhood. They are popping up more and more often. Lazy people are what some are turning into, and our city is allowing it to happen. Eileen McDermott of Cedar Rapids. Next letter is from Gary Klein of Iowa City. Attacks on Franken don't suit Grassley. Leave it to very senior Senator Chuck Grassley to attack Mike Franken for supposedly dissing rural Iowans. Mike Franken is rural Iowa. He grew up in Lebanon, Iowa, in a town of less than 50. He left to serve in the Navy and lives in Sioux City today. This type of opponent swift boating has been Grassley's cover for not working for Iowans with disabilities or protecting a woman's right to choose and blocking Supreme Court nominations when it suited him. Iowans should be asking, who does Chuck Grassley think he is? Gary Klein of Iowa City. Next, Mark Konzett of Cedar Rapids writes, good candidates need support to win. Edmund Burke said, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Perhaps it would do us all good to take note of these challenging words and then say a prayer and ask the good Lord what part he would have you play. Here in Linn County, we have a slate of Republican candidates who made the decision to answer the call and have stepped up to be part of the solution to the evil that is seemingly becoming more prevalent day by day. I can't help but think how each of these candidates must have felt as they decided to file their official papers. Maybe it was, well, here we go, or maybe here goes nothing, or Geronimo, or maybe even let's roll. Regardless of the thoughts that were rolling around in their minds in that moment, none of them made the decision to run for office thinking they were going it alone. No, they each knew that for them to succeed, it would take the help of their families. It would involve help from you and me and their neighbors all working together for the common good. For you see, Edmund Burke went on to say, when bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle. Mark Konzett of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 11th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Network. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. The other notices from Cedar Rapids, Parish Marcel Harris, age 30, died Tuesday, September 6th, Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center of Cedar Rapids, handling arrangements. Richard Luce, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, September 9th, Tien Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids, handling arrangements. And Melvin Lee Campbell, age 89, of Marion, died Wednesday, September 7th, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, handling arrangements. Michael Grant Carpenter, age 65, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, August 16th, at the University of Iowa Hospital following a brief illness. Memorial services will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday, September 15th, at Oakland Church of the Nazarene by Pastor Dave King. Charlene Ann Duffy, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, September 7th, at Stony Point Meadows Assisted Living Center following a short illness. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Friday, at St. Pius X Catholic Church by the Reverend John Seda. Burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery. A rosary will be recited on Thursday at 4 p.m. at Tien Funeral Home. Those not attending the service may visit the family from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Thursday and on Friday at the church after 9 a.m. Charlene worked at Rockwell Collins for 29 years, retiring in 1993. Growing up, Charlene would go fishing with her best friend Mary Ann. She liked listening to all different types of music and took great pleasure in baking and sewing. She enjoyed wintering in Phoenix, going to Las Vegas, and was a St. Louis Cardinals fan. Barbara Ann Hart, age 62, of Cedar Rapids, took leave of this earth on Thursday, September 1st, while at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She unexpectedly collapsed into the arms of her family on August 30th while recovering from surgery. Despite the great efforts made to save her, it was at this time she joined her parents in heaven. Barb enjoyed being a stay-at-home mom for many years. She made every holiday, birthday, and snow day extra special. She was a Christian and attended Knoll Ridge Baptist Church for many years, where she was also a Sunday school teacher. Barb enjoyed volunteering and later began working at Garfield Elementary School as their volunteer coordinator in 1993. She enjoyed gardening, shopping at thrift stores, and collecting Raggedy Ann dolls. Mama did not like funerals and will be honored through a Celebration of Life funeral on Friday, August 25th, 2023, with a private graveside service at Lenox Cemetery planned on Sunday, August 27th, 2023, after the annual Ancestors Picnic at the New Jerusalem Church in Norway. The funeral will be held at a time when grief is past and at a time when all of her grandchildren can attend and have fun in her memory. Betty Hines, known as Lucy, age 91 of Anamosa, passed away Saturday, September 3rd. A memorial mass celebrating Lucy's life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, September 21st at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Anamosa. Interment will be in Holy Cross Cemetery in Anamosa. Lucy was a cosmetologist for many years. She was a member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church and enjoyed golfing, bowling, and cards. Alicia Havlick, 98, of Cedar Rapids, passed away September 1st in her home in Allen, Texas. Celebration of Life services will be held at Our Lady of Angels Catholic Church in Allen, Texas, and Barash Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Burial will be in Czech National Cemetery. Alicia moved with her family to Cedar Rapids in 1970, where she worked as a bookkeeper in the family business of commercial real estate and numerous other ventures. Visitation will be held at Turrentine Jackson Morrow Funeral Home on Friday, September 9th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Minnie Knox, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, September 5th at her home. Services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, September 15th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. prior to the service. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Minnie was a longstanding member of Bethel AME Church. Very active, always believed in helping others until her stroke in 2007. She enjoyed bowling, playing cards, and cooking. She was a member and secretary for the Padmore Temple 729 Eastern Star, along with the Criterion Club, the Iowa Association of Colored Women Club, and NAACP. She worked several different places and retired from CryoVac. Michael Behnke, age 69, of Anamosa, died Wednesday, September 7th, at the Silver Oak Nursing Center in Marion following an extended illness. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, September 17th, at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa, where friends may call after 9 a.m. Interment will be in the Riverside Cemetery. Mike was a CNA in Anamosa and Cedar Rapids, and he enjoyed going fishing in his spare time. Sue Ellen McGoy of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully on September 4th. A reception will be held at 11 a.m., followed by a celebration service of song at noon, September 18th, at First Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids. Sue enjoyed being a leader for her son in Cub Scouts, for her daughter in Girl Scouts. She loved singing until her voice came out and sang in the church choir. She volunteered at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum for over 20 years, in roles ranging from docent to impersonating Dolly Madison. She served on the Cedar Rapids Council on Aging, including the board, and she and Dick enjoyed traveling for America's Boating Club Power Squadron, conferences with the River Rats on island pleasure cruises. She cherished her PEO sisters. Mark Larson Randall, age 68, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, August 28th, after a courageous battle with cancer. An avid fisherman who found great joy on the lake in pursuit of the next big muskie, Mark was a devoted Nebraska Cornhuskers fan until the very end. He entered the United States Air Force on September 14, 1971, and he began his career with Allstate Insurance Company in 1979 and moved to the United Fire Casualty Company in 1981. A memorial service and luncheon will be held Saturday, October 8th, at Grace Lutheran Church, 7800 150th Street, West Apple Valley, Minnesota. Visitation will be held at 10 a.m. and service at 11 a.m., with private interment to follow Monday at Fort Snelling National Cemetery, honoring Mark as an Air Force veteran. Evelyn Geraldine Mulman, known as Jerry, age 93, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Sunday, July 24th, at Methwick. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, September 14th, at 10 a.m., and memorial service at 11 a.m. at Salem United Methodist Church, 3715 33rd Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. William Herbert Ray, age 79, of Cedar Rapids, died suddenly of natural causes on August 19th in his home in Cedar Rapids. William served as active duty in the U.S. Army from 1965 to 1967. He then taught at the high school level in Carroll for several years and then at the middle school level in Rawlins, Wyoming for many years. After leaving education, he worked as a skilled machinist involved with appliance manufacturing, primarily at the Mana Factory in eastern Iowa. He was active in his union and a strong supporter of organized labor. A memorial service will be announced at a future date. After cremation by Cedar Memorial, Ray's ashes will be buried with a memorial tree on his son's property in Michigan. Patricia Ann Wilderman, 81, passed away peacefully on Thursday, September 8th, surrounded by her family. There will be graveside services at a later date. Patricia had many things to be proud of in her life. She was a legal assistant for 50 years and a respected member of the legal community. She was a region commissioner of the Hawkeye Area Council for Boy Scouts of America and past president of Eagles Club. Charlotte Marie Stoltzfus, 82, of Coralville, passed away on September 9th. A memorial service is scheduled at 4 p.m. Sunday, September 25th, at First Mennonite Church in Iowa City. For a complete obituary, you can visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home Cremation Service website. Robert Edward Noble, known as Bob, age 60, of Hazleton and previously of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, August 25th, at his home after a short illness. Private family services will be held at a later date. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. Bob did inventory and production work for Akko Feeds from 1972 to 1982, worked at Best Built Garage from 1990 to 1996, and most recently worked at Dan's Overhead Doors from 1995 to 2008. He was an avid golfer, and he loved spending time outdoors and was a big sports fan, with his favorite team being the Green Bay Packers. AC/DC was his favorite band. Charles Alvin Zesimer, age 99, of Marion, passed away on Monday, September 5th, at Anamosa Care Center in Anamosa. Private family services will be held with the Nerman in Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Charles served honorably in the U.S. Army from 1944 to 1946 during World War II and took part in the Battle of the Bulge. He worked as a machinist for National Oats in Cedar Rapids, retiring in 1985. He was a member of the VFW and Lutheran Church of the Resurrection in Marion. Charles enjoyed fishing, watching stock car races, Cubs baseball, and his retirement hobby of restoring a 1929 Chevy. Wilma Novotny, age 96, of Murrieta, California, and formerly of Victor, Iowa, passed away peacefully on August 2nd. A private family graveside service will be held on Tuesday, September 20th, at Victor Memorial Cemetery in Victor. Wilma and Elmer took over the Carnforth Inn from Elmer's mother, Agnes, in 1968. Wilma was known for her pie baking, for the restaurant, for her wedding and birthday cake baking, and decorating for her many salad recipes. She was a 4-H leader for many years. Patrick Glenn Klaus, age 39, of Omaha, Nebraska, formerly of Mount Vernon, passed away July 22nd at his home. Visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, September 18th at Community Bible Church, Mount Vernon, followed by a remembrance service at 3 p.m. Barbara Ann Sovereign, age 78, of Marion, passed away Thursday, September 8th. A private family service will be held at a later date. Barbara was an active member and volunteer of many community groups, including the Junior League of Cedar Rapids, the Retired Senior Volunteer Program, or RSVP, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Child Celebration of the Arts, the Science Station, Mercy Medical Center Auxiliary, and the Pribble Junior Golf Tournament. An avid fitness and health enthusiast, Barbara was one of the first instructors to teach yoga in the metropolitan area. Eleanor Jane Henneke of Palo, on September 3rd, she passed away. She was a lifelong resident of the Palo-Shelsburg area. She was known as Jane, born April 18th, 1939. Visitation will be held Saturday, September 17th, at Cedar Memorial's Chapel of Memories from 9 to 10:30 a.m. directly followed by a 10:30 a.m. Celebration of Life ceremony, private family interment following the service. As an adult, Jane had many jobs. Most notably was her time as an Avon lady in Atkins and her time in the Armstrong's department store in Home Goods. Her real passion was raising her family and taking care of the home and supporting her husband. She spent her later years as the glue that held her family together, planning family gatherings and keeping all communication open. Joshua Andrew Hendricks, age 46, of Palo, formerly of Center Point, died Monday, September 5th. Per his wishes, cremation has taken place. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point is assisting the family. A celebration of Joshua's life will be announced at a later date. Joshua worked as project manager for Hawkeye Electric, where he was a respected colleague and leader. He was a member of IBEW Local 405 for over 20 years and formerly served as an elected councilman to the Center Point City Council. Joshua was also instructor at Farrell's Extreme Body Shaping, an Iowa State champion pool player, and lifelong Chicago Cubs and Kansas City Chiefs fan. Roland C. Fisher of Port Orange, Florida, we are heartbroken to share the loss of our beloved father on August 20th at the age of 81. In his younger years, he enjoyed dirt track racing at Hawkeye Downs and other Eastern Iowa racing circuits. Ron built, painted, and raced his own cars in the mid-60s, spanning into the 70s. He earned several season championships and many other wins throughout his racing career. The family plans to hold a private graveside service in Ormond Beach, Florida, where he will be laid to rest. And Betty Ina Lynn of Charlotte, North Carolina, died on Labor Day, September 5th, a fitting date for a woman who worked so hard her entire life. She was born over 100 years ago on March 8, 1922, in Argyle, Iowa. Betty attended Northeast Missouri State Teachers College in Kirksville, Missouri, from 1940 to 42, which has since been renamed Truman State University. She completed her course of study there and then went to work as a civilian at the Rock Island Arsenal, which has manufactured military equipment. She was always very proud of her service there to the country during the Second World War. In the early 1950s, she moved with her young family to a farm southwest of Tipton on Green Road where they grew row crops, corn and soybeans, made hay, and raised cattle and hogs. Betty and Lester were devoted members for many years of the Rochester, Iowa United Methodist Church. A funeral service for Betty will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, September 4th at the United Methodist Church in Rochester, Iowa. Turning to the sports page, Mike Kloss writes, "Downpour cleansing for ISU, gloomy for Iowa." Elusive win over Hawkeyes is the latest feather in Campbell's cap in Iowa City. Iowa's six-game football winning streak over Iowa State has been broken, and broken is the operative word in Hawkeye land. We'll get to the Hawkeyes' shattered offense in a bit. First, you have to really, really hand it to Iowa State for shrugging off some awful red zone blues of its own and earning its victory against Iowa's vaunted defense Saturday at Kinnick Stadium. The Cyclones' 10-7 triumph was a team effort, strange as that may seem, with such a low score. Their defense, obviously, was sensational. They dominated Iowa's offensive line nearly in the entire game, denying the run and getting in quarterback Spencer Petras' face repeatedly. Petras' accuracy was nothing of the sort, and the whole cockamamie offense was just brutal for the second Saturday in a row. Iowa State's offense, meanwhile, came up huge on one drive, and what a drive it was. The Cyclones went 99 yards, maybe 99.5 yards, or even 99.7, in 21 plays for the winning fourth-quarter touchdown. It was 11 minutes and 49 seconds of hell for the Hawkeyes' defense after 3-plus hours of it for the Iowa fans watching their team's hopelessness on offense. The Hawkeyes' points came after getting the ball at the ISU 16 following one of Lucas Van Ness's two-block punts and... what? That's right, Iowa blocked a pair of Cyclone punts, both putting the ball in the Hawkeyes' red zone, and they still didn't win the game. Oh, Iowa State scored a total of 3 points in three first-half red zone appearances, and it still didn't lose the game. The downpour that plagued the game's last 5 minutes was symbolic on both sides. This was a cleansing for the Cyclones, who had beaten every Big 12 opponent home and away in Matt Campbell's tenure as head coach, but had never gotten past Iowa. Campbell's crew had gotten Oklahoma's goat, had messed with Texas. Now, finally, it has shut down and shut up its state rival. For the Hawkeyes, the rain and gray skies just added to the gloom. Iowa had 150 yards, which would be unbelievable if it weren't so believable. The 166 yards it had in a 7-3 win over South Dakota State is now the team's high water mark. You can win one game the way the Hawkeyes won last week's, but two was a bridge too far. It's not as if Iowa State's defense came in with a reputation equaling that of Iowa's Southeast Missouri State. had 247 first-half yards against the Cyclones the week before, though SEMO was on the wrong side of a 42-10 beating. However, the Cyclones' defense was superior here to Iowa's acclaimed unit. When push came to shove, Iowa couldn't go 99 yards for a score, or 88, or 77, or more than 16. "It's not representative of our offense," Petras said. "Isn't it, though? I truly do believe there's good in front of this unit. It's the second week of September, and it's already been the weirdest, ugliest season the Hawkeyes have had in who knows how long. And guess what? Iowa will play other good defenses and others that aren't terrible." Iowa State, meanwhile, came into the Iowa game with dialed-down expectations and bussed home with a trophy that hasn't called Ames home in a while. The Cyclones have a quarterback line of succession, with sophomore Hunter Deckers picking up admirably after Brock Purdy's graduation to the NFL. Deckers came into this house of horrors and noise for opposing quarterbacks, shook off early mishaps, and got the job done. He completed two-thirds of his passes, not less than half like Petras. His blockers contributed mightily to that effort, holding Iowa to one sack. Iowa's top three QBs are from California, Colorado, and Ohio. Iowa State's number one guy is from Hawarden. He did his Northwest Iowa hometown and his Cyclone team proud Saturday. Iowa State is a good football program that has a lot of achievements since Campbell took over, things the Cyclones simply had never before done. But now, Campbell and his guys got themselves the big missing piece. They vanquished Iowa in Kinnick and were clearly the better team in doing so. And in a high school football rewind, Prairie bounces back, by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette, in Cedar Falls. After a rough season-opening loss, Cedar Rapids Prairie has bounced back with two strong victories. The Hawks' rebound intersected with some revenge. Prairie lost a heartbreaker to Cedar Falls last season, taking the lead in the final minute only to allow the decisive touchdown with 7 seconds remaining in a 24-21 thriller. This time, the Hawks left nothing to chance, and leading throughout and dropping Class 5A 6th-ranked Cedar Falls 24-7 on Friday night at the Unidome. It was Prairie's first win at Cedar Falls since 2013. "Our kids were pretty resilient," Prairie coach Mark Bliss said. "They came off the ball and did some good things. They were focused. I think that taste was still in their mouth from last year. They wanted to make sure they got rid of that taste." Cedar Falls hadn't given up a point through the first 2 weeks. Mikkel Taylor cracked that goose egg with a 76-yard touchdown run in the first quarter. He posted his second straight 100-yard game, rushing for 113 yards and 12 carries, and increasing his season total to 350 and 55. Taylor has also scored in all three games this year. Prairie's rush attack amassed 279 yards with 170 before halftime as the Hawks build a 17-7 lead at the break. "I was excited we were able to do that to them because of the two shutouts," Bliss said. "We knew it was going to be physical. We knew it was going to be a battle. For us to go out and do what we did was a good thing." Prairie's defense stifled the Tigers, who outscored Johnston and Waterloo West by a combined 71-0. The Hawks' defense kept Cedar Falls out of the end zone and allowed just 141 yards of total offense, including 67 on the ground. The Tigers' lone touchdown was from a kickoff return. "Our biggest thing is controlling the line of scrimmage on both sides of the ball, and that's kind of our credo," Bliss said. Prairie plays at Bettendorf, 0-3 in Week 4. Muscatine's Ty Kozad rushed for 391 yards and a 37-34 win over the Bulldogs on Friday. The Wolves win. Marion notched its first victory over the season, knocking off Class 3A No. 7 Benton Community 38-14 at Thomas Park. The Wolves snapped a 7-game losing streak. The Wolves matched their win total from last season. "The biggest thing we need to do is to understand that we haven't arrived or finished in our journey," Marion coach Michael Joyner said. "It's cliche, but it's all a process. But building on wins is much more enjoyable than trying to find it after a loss." Marion, 1-2, held the Bobcats to just 104 yards of offense and one rushing TD. And Pirates' strong start. Albernette moved to 3-0 this season behind another staunch defensive effort. The Pirates recorded their second straight shutout, beating host Lisbon 14-0 on Friday night. Albernette downed Pekin 42-0 last week and haven't allowed a point since the fourth quarter of its 16-13 season opening victory over North Lynn. Albernette has posted its best start in 7 seasons. This marks the first time the Pirates have won their first 3 games since starting 6-0 in 2015. They faced East Buchanan, 2-1, next week at home. Turning to the Time Machine section, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. 1922 conversation led to a symphony in Cedar Rapids. Orchestra has had 5 directors in its 100 years. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. A city without music would be a city without a soul, Gazette columnist Nadine Subotnick wrote in 1946. She was writing about the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra, now known as Orchestra Iowa, then in its 25th season. The orchestra is celebrating its 100th season this year into next. The idea for the orchestra started in 1922 when well-known flautist E.A. Hazelton dropped into the office of Dr. J. Lynn Crawford, according to a 1928 Gazette story. That conversation led to the forming of two musical groups in 1923, the Cedar Rapids Choral Society and the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra. The Gazette reported on February 13, 1923, that the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra was organized last night in the Chamber of Commerce. 40 leading musicians of the city attended the first meeting and took part in the first practice. With the promise of others to join, the orchestra will probably consist of more than 50 pieces, the story added, saying it already included the best players in our city. In March 1923, co-college professor Joseph Kitchen was named the orchestra's director. Its first performance was April 13, 1923, in Coe's Sinclair Memorial Chapel. The all-volunteer orchestra had 48 musicians for that first concert, 17 of them women. The program included an oratorio by the Choral Society under the direction of co-professor Marshall Bidwell. In May, the Choral Society and the orchestra gave their first pop concert at the City Auditorium. On December 18, 1923, the two groups presented Handel's Messiah in the Coe College Chapel. A Gazette reviewer praised the vocals, adding, "The work of the Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra cannot be too highly praised. It was not merely good support for the chorus and soloist, but was an integral part of the whole." The symphony organization became permanent March 17, 1924. There was no oboe player for the symphony's 1925-26 season, so Crawford, who played the cello and flute, traveled to Chicago each week to take oboe lessons. Bidwell, an expert organist, took up playing kettle drums that season, too. In 1928, orchestra members embraced the Coliseum in the new Veterans Memorial Building, knowing it offered more room for performances. 55 musicians performed in the first series of concerts in the new space. Many of the musicians were professionals who gave up being paid to be part of the concerts. Financing was usually handled through fundraising campaigns, season tickets, and contributions. But when finances were tight in 1936 during the Depression, the symphony charged for a star concert as a season opener. The rest of the season's concerts were free. In 1952, the orchestra's president, Otto Ambos, asked the American Orchestra Symphony League to critique the orchestra. The review was not favorable, and it led Kitchen to search for his own replacement. A pay scale was instituted, and Kitchen hired Henry Denneke, who became the orchestra's first salaried director. Denneke stayed until 1969, bringing talent from the University of Iowa and expanding the concert series. Richard Williams came next. He significantly increased audiences, and the budget expanded. The American Orchestra Symphony League designated the symphony as Iowa's first metropolitan orchestra, allowing it to apply for grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. The symphony also found a new home in 1976 in the restored Paramount Theater downtown. Christian Tiemeyer took the orchestra's helm in 1982. In his 22 years with the orchestra, he instituted the Pops series, the Discovery series, and the Showcase Chamber series, offering operas and opening the Symphony School of Music. He retired in 2005, succeeded by maestro Timothy Hankowicz. The Cedar Rapids Symphony Orchestra celebrated its 66th year in 1988, making it the oldest symphony west of the Mississippi. In its 75th season in 1996, the orchestra had 72 members and was operating the black with a $1.3 million budget. After the flood of 2008 swamped the Paramount Theater, the orchestra began touring the state, leading to its name change to Orchestra Iowa. And here are a few things you can do this week from the Hoopla section. In theater, Chipmunked, when comedian Megan Gogarty gets bitten by a chipmunk in her backyard, it sets off an increasingly alarming chain of disasters for her and her family. That's 2 p.m. today and 7:30 p.m. Thursday to Saturday at Riverside Theater, 119 East College Street in Iowa City, $15 to $35. Learn to curl. These one-time beginner courses in curling last 90 minutes and are a great opportunity to try a different, fun activity. No experience or equipment is necessary. Registration is required. 7 to 8:30 p.m. on Wednesday at the I'm on Ice Arena, 1100 Rockford Road Southwest in Cedar Rapids. That is $15. The fundraiser Brunost. This lively evening features unlimited food and beverages from some of the area's finest restaurants, local breweries and distilleries, along with international beers, wine, and spirits. The event includes live music, auctions, and a drawing for a trip for two to Prague. That's from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. Friday at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library at 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest in Cedar Rapids, and that is $55 to $135 VIP. And Theater Yellow, this play chronicles a year in the life of the perfect family in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Bobby Westmoreland and his wife Kate have two ambitious children in high school, son Dane and daughter Gracie. Gracie's best friend is a young gay boy who is at constant odds with his abusive mother. That's 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and 2 p.m. on September 18th at Giving Tree Theater, 752 10th Street in Marion. That is $23. And more theater, Little Shop of Horrors. City Circle presents this deviously delicious smash musical. When fumbling for floral assistant Seymour discovers a new and unusual breed of plant, the foul-mouthed R&B singing carnivore promises unending fame and fortune as long as Seymour keeps feeding it blood. At 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday and 2 p.m. on September 18th at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts, 1301 5th Street in Coralville, the cost is $17 to $30. That brings me to the end of reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 11th, 2022. I have selected and lightly edited the articles from today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. My name is Sharon Faldudo. I have been reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.